Welcome to the FutureCast, the Institute for the Future's ongoing conversation about signals of emerging innovations and disruptions that will make the future.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the second FutureCast, IFTF's monthly podcast with occasional technological glitches. Today is December 17th, 2009, and I'm Jerry Mikulski, your host. With me virtually are several senior IFTFers, Kathy Vian, Jomé Cassio, David Evan Harris, Chris Arkenberg, and Jason Tester, and probably a couple others, as well as our guests, Eric Corey Fried, Allison Arieff, and June Williamson. We will hold these calls monthly, but not on a set schedule. We'll post the podcast to iTunes and to the IFTF site. We are actually live chatting on Twitter with the hashtag FutureCast. Please feel free to forward information about these calls to anyone who might be interested. And then one last request. When you do jump into the conversation, please say your name each time so we know who's speaking. Today's call is about the suburbs. And there's a really wonderful conversation going on in many different places about revitalizing cities and housing and life in general, and taking back empty lots and redesigning cities for pedestrian zones and changing the bus systems. There's a lot of wonderful redevelopment and rethinking going on. But we'd like to draw everyone's attention to the suburbs that pose some really special problems. And I will introduce it by only mentioning two things, because I think that our guests know much more about what's going on than I do. But first, we sort of created the suburbs out of the 40s, 50s, 60s. We kind of built these suburban idols, and we took the wartime economy and shifted it to this American myth that everybody should live with a white picket fence way out from town and then commute into work somehow. And then the huge subprime foreclosure crisis that just came through. So marry those two thoughts for just a moment, and you'll begin to get a small feeling for what's going on in a lot of American suburbs. And I think to get more texture for it, we should go to our guests and start exploring the issue. So let me just introduce Eric, June, and Allison quickly with a couple different questions. Eric, you recently were part of a contest called Reburbia for people to reimagine how the suburbs might evolve in these sort of circumstances. Can you tell us a little bit about what motivated the contest and maybe just frame the notion of rethinking the suburbs for us?
Well, the contest really came about from Jill and Habitat and Sarah Rich from Dwell, who had this idea that the time had come to maybe re-examine suburbia and ask questions that hadn't been asked in a long time. And I guess I was lucky enough to be one of the judges on it. And it was funny because as an architect, I think I went in there with an idea of what I was going to see, almost that I was expecting to see. And to both my delight and a little bit of my disappointment, the things that I saw were well beyond what I anticipated. And so what's funny is it is this underlying context that everybody almost unanimously agrees that the suburbs stink, you know, that they need to change. That almost, you know, wasn't even raised as a question. Nobody submitted a proposal for, let's say, making the suburbs more suburban. Mm-hmm. All of the proposals were really centered around the idea of making them much more livable. And by contrast, that means that right now they're not. And, of course, I think we all kind of agree with that.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see the suburban dilemma? I described it in really primitive terms, sort of with a couple blunt sticks. Can you put some finer edge to it?
The suburban dilemma falls on multiple categories and kind of transcends various aspects of sustainability and livability and even construction. So first you have this faded idea of this American dream that you're going to, you know, have your own plot of land and be one with nature. You know, and you go out and you buy a house in a place called, you know, Quail Run or something, where they've obviously decimated all the quail in order to build the houses.
And then quail had to run. That's why they called it Quail Run, right?
Yeah, and then what I've experienced is that the houses really are the same no matter where they are in the country. So whether they're in Arizona or whether they're in Alaska, they're pretty much built the same way, and they're always built to the minimum standards of whatever the local codes, you know, kind of put upon the developers. And that's kind of been the problem. So this, you know, this falsified American dream that you're going to live out in the rural area and kind of have this big backyard, it doesn't really exist anymore. If you really look at the developments that have gone on in the last 10 years, they've all been pretty much zero lot line with 5 feet between the neighbors just for fire code minimum safety, and you know, and nobody uses their front yard at all anymore, and the backyard is all fenced in, so you have your little stake and you kind of ignore it. And it's only been in places that you've seen, you know, kind of a handful of communities around the country where people have started taking those fences down and really looked at, no, let's make a place that we want to live in.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. So let me go ahead and bring our other guests in. But as a side note, the Frost poem, Mending Wall, is often quoted for its line, good fences make good neighbors. And yet the whole poem is about, why do we have these fences? The fences are mostly unnecessary. So I think we, as a society, we're beginning to face that. June, you've authored a book about how people are beginning to take back different parts of suburbia. What sort of things are happening?
Well, my co-author, Ellen Dunham Jones, and I wrote the book to really look at a lot of retrofitting projects that have already taken place over the past 10, 15 years for redeveloping conventional suburban property types or suburban form, that is the single-use, car-dependent, low-density development that proliferated in the post-war period. And we found most of the examples were on sort of the larger lot parcels, especially in the inner or older suburbs, that have failed and need to be rethought. So the shopping centers, regional malls, office parks, or garden apartment complexes, often mm-hmm. with a sort of single owner. And we looked at ways they've been retrofitted, and examples ranged from, you know, whole-scale redevelopment, you know, sort of building from scratch a more mixed-use, walkable development, to just re-inhabiting the structures, adaptive reuse of the boxes, and then also re-greening examples that involve coming back and doing some environmental repair to the more wasteful development strategies and zoning that have been pursued in the past half century.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, and there's lots of different things. I remember being in Buenos Aires a long time ago and seeing that the university had taken over an old church that had been decommissioned or desanctified, or I've forgotten what it's called exactly. And in the middle of the church, they poured concrete slab for three stories high, and they had classrooms in it.
Mm-hmm.
It was ugly. It was ugly as sin, but it was definitely repurposing of a structure.
Well, there's a whole slew of examples of old Walmart stores that have been turned into churches across the country.
Well, which is a trend that goes nicely with the megachurch trend as well, right?
Yes, lots of parking.
Allison, go ahead. Is that you? Go ahead.
Yes, I had a couple thoughts on what's been said so far. Eric, I'm sure that you didn't mean, when you got the entries, you said that everyone sort of disagreed that suburbia was something to be saved and sort of wanted to rethink it. But I think what's also important to note is that there are tons of people who love suburbia just the way it is and don't
yes.
tend to see any of the problems that we see. And I think what struck me most when I wrote a Times column about this, which was by far the most commented and remarked upon thing I've ever written for the Times, I think I got 500 comments on it, was suburbanites telling me, the city person, to back off, that I didn't know what I was talking about, and you know, why did city people always think that they wanted to tell suburbanites what to do? And I think that this is sort of a really interesting ongoing divide that I hadn't even really been thinking about that much when I was writing the piece. I mean, I grew up in suburbia, but I grew up, this is another distinction I'd like to make, in a good suburb. I grew up in Marin County, and I could walk to school, and I could walk to sort of basic services, and it's sort of a lovely place to grow up. But they don't really make suburbs like that now. So mm-hmm. I think that's always important to sort of make all these distinctions about that there are different sort of models that exist, and there are still plenty of people who, yes, they don't have all the things that we think are important, but maybe they're not missing them, which is not to say that they're, like, the best options, but that it's important to kind of include that in the debate. Also, I'd be interested to know, in terms of what's being retrofitted, if anyone on this call is aware of anything that's happening sort of over and above the restructuring of an individual building? Like, has anyone seen, because I haven't yet really seen evidence of sort of a systems-wide change to, say, a suburban development, that it's not just a matter of re-inhabiting a building in a different way, but changing the streetscape, introducing more public transportation, that sort of thing.
Well,
I think has to go hand in hand.
We have examples of that in our book that we, in the bulk of the examples really are the single property retrofits, but there are examples of rethinking the street, and often that involves overhauling the zoning, and examples like Arlington in Virginia, really rethinking the whole strip, and that is maybe a generation after the metro rail was put in. So you're seeing the kind of system-wide recognition of the transit-oriented development opportunities around stations that were originally conceived as kind of park-and-ride facilities. So filling in that asphalt with development over time and then rethinking the streetscape. And there are examples and initiatives for taking state highways, which have certain, you know, road engineer kind of standards, and transforming those along specific corridors of just a few blocks or a half mile or so when they transition into a more built-up area where you can maybe have a multi-way boulevard and slow down the traffic and introduce pedestrian stuff and bring the buildings out to the street. So Cathedral City in California is an example of that.
Okay.
Interesting. I think in other countries, I'm seeing bigger examples of this sort of thing. In Beijing, there's a 798 art zone called Dashanzi, which used to be, I think, a military base and was effectively just opened up and is now a really interesting art zone with, I think, living lofts and things like that and restaurants and so forth tucked inside of it. But that would have been a big military base, so one facility again. I don't know if that qualifies. Go ahead. Eric, was that you jumping in?
Yeah, I wanted to kind of point out that what I've discovered is that the people that live in the suburbs do love it, but I think that they love it the same way that they almost love their political party, and that they're living in contrast to the one other alternative that they think they have. So the suburban people always seem to point out, well, we're not in the city, and the city's awful, and the city's evil, and it's dirty, and filthy, and crime-ridden, and they think that simply by juxtaposition of the contrast, that's why they like it so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I'm envisioning, and I know a lot of people are envisioning, a third alternative, almost like a third party, a third alternative to that can, for lack of a better word, have the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
It's funny because I think that part of the problem here is that if you're not in a community where half of the houses are now empty and going derelict, and if you're not in Flint, Michigan, where the jobs have all gone and your neighborhoods are really desperate and you're thinking of tearing down half the city to rescue the city, then you might be in actually a thriving neighborhood and you might be having weekend softball games and picnics in the park, and then your life might actually be quite fine. Global warming and commuting and other sorts of issues aside, you might not notice a lot of the trends that we're talking about here. So is this just a situational thing where people really do love their burbs until the burbs break?
Well, I would say one of the things that needs to help move this conversation forward is the recognition that suburbia is incredibly diverse. And it's diverse by region, it's diverse by, you know, the dates or the time periods when areas were developed. It's diverse by the economic and socioeconomic conditions. So, you know, there are more Americans living in poverty in suburbs than in cities right now. And I think these things need to be, you know, sort of recognized, that there's a real diversity of experience in suburbs. And that, I think, will help the solutions being pursued make them specific to the regions and the areas where they're occurring, and to have the conversation be regional to better understand how the interdependency of suburban areas and the adjacent cities, that it's all really has to be understood as one big overlapping system. And then you can have these weird juxtapositions where you have very thriving residential neighborhoods with all the single ownership and a lot of sweat equity invested in the houses, and the commercial strip right adjacent that had been thriving when it was first built be completely decimated.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these odd juxtapositions, and there can be some resistance to retrofitting those strips, partly out of fear of what might replace them, and rather just leave them in their semi-derelict state. So that's part of the conversation as well. I think.
Also, there's infrastructural questions about, you know, roads, public trans, and a variety of other things, including budgetary issues about if you're really going to do a tear down and rebuild some sort of thing. That's a non-standard structure probably you're going to build in a non-standard process. And sometimes tearing down these structures, in particular if you've got a really long, long parking lot that you need to somehow dig up, seem pretty non-economical when you're staring at them. Are there any clever ways that communities and businesses are tackling these things together to create enough force or enough funding that those different obstacles can begin to move together?
Well, I will say that as radical as it may seem to tear these things down, if you think about what was sort of torn down to put the suburbs in at the beginning, I think rebuilding them is no less dramatic. It's just perhaps not developer motivated and doesn't have sort of all the muscle behind it in that respect. But I think there's a lot of interesting this speaks a lot to kind of the big box retrofit and all that, but if you expand on sort of the general idea of, say, a big box retrofit example, since most of these, a lot of these newer suburban communities tend to be quite close to, say, a Walmart-type mall, there are several groups doing things like Sky Vegetables, which is trying to do agriculture on top of big box stores, as well as a sort of urban farming efforts like Growing Power, which we do it on sort of a vacated piece of land. But if you begin, and this is sort of how this relates to infrastructure, if you begin to think of what it might do for a community's economic health if their food was grown locally where it hadn't been before, and what sort of job creation and food cost decreases might come with that. I mean, I think there's a lot of innovative thinking happening around that. To think of retail and kind of how you can build on some of these existing places. And they go beyond, I think, what's happened thus far in big box retrofits.
To follow up with that, with Allison's comment, there's an incredible amount of acreage available out there, and there will be more in the future. By one estimate, currently we have 1.1 million acres in shopping centers throughout the country. That's 5.6 times the land area of New York City. So that's a lot of acreage across the country that's in this sort of underperforming asphalt. And you know, we've had the foreclosure crisis in the housing sector, and many analysts expect there's going to be another wave or a real credit crisis in the commercial real estate sector that hasn't quite, right. You know, the other shoe waiting to drop. And
especially the malls we're talking about.
Yes, more dead malls, more ghost boxes to occur. So there's a lot of availability to redirect growth from the urban edge, the suburban edge, the exurban areas, redirected into this land that's going to be available. And I think these suggestions for repurposing it, for regreening it, for making those landscapes into productive landscapes rather than consumptive ones is a really big idea that is going to be need to be examined. But one of the complications there is the way that suburbs are managed as sort of home rule, smaller municipalities that are often set in competition with one another and have competed over time for the tax dollars associated with commercial real estate development. And that whole pattern needs to be changed, because a lot of these smaller municipalities are really going to be without revenues.
Yeah, and also mall law, basically. Some of these are, in fact, legal fiefdoms that have their own legal structures inside their own police forces. And in fact, many of these were granted, many stores and many of big boxes were granted incredible tax breaks when they came in. So there's all sorts of funkiness going on here. And there's this really negative cycle where, and I'm going to over stereotype the process here, but a big box store comes in, small stores downtown die, the downtown dies, then the big box store decides, maybe it decides to move just a couple miles away instead of amplifying the store that it's in. But it's cheaper to build a new, bigger box that's nicer and newer than it is to retrofit the existing store. So now you have a dead downtown and a big dead big box store.
Right.
It's pretty awful. So And so to go away from the really negative trend run here, I just wanted to go back to Eric and say, can you describe a little bit more about that third alternative you're talking about? And then I want to open this up to my colleagues at IFTF and then everyone else who's on the call.
Well, just almost to go back to what June had said, you know, this idea of each town being its own little fiefdom, that each town considers itself almost autonomous, it starts to be preposterous when you really start to look at it. You know, right now I'm in Palm Springs, California. Palm Springs is part of a larger economic region called the Coachella Valley, and there's 9 cities here, and they're all butted up against each other. There's no space between the towns. So in a typical experience, you might drive through 4 or 5 of these quote-unquote cities and cross these imaginary boundaries without thinking of them. But each city doesn't look at it that way. Each city thinks of themselves as their own thing, and some even have different trash pickups. So there's this built-in redundancy and overlap of infrastructure that occurs with police forces and city halls and so forth. So one of the things that I've been trying to do is areas like this to talk to one another and start to realize that that the idea of holding on to your own little sense of individuality doesn't need to come from this imaginary boundary. The personality of your town can come from something more cultural and something more meaningful. And getting them to talk to each other is almost impossible.
I'm not sure it's impossible. There's a wonderful story and video told by the tree people down in Los Angeles. And the head of tree people managed to get a lot of different LA agencies to begin to talk to each other and see each other differently. So that they began to understand that budgets that they had were actually counterproductive one to the other. And if they thought together and worked together, they could reduce the amount of money spent overall and improve the impact on the LA basin, basically on the whole watershed. It was very, very interesting stuff. I'll post a link to Twitter of that video.
But one of the things that I've been seeing is that in talking to developers, you know, developers will come to me and say, we want to green up our project. And I think that they assume that they're going to have me say they should, you know, use low VOC paints and all this other nonsense. And what I tell them is that what we really need to do is rethink the entire economic model. You know, the idea that you're building these boxes one at a time and selling them off and then trying to essentially disconnect your responsibility from them after that really needs to change. So one of the things we've been working on is this idea that that they essentially get into the power business. So they put the solar panels on the roof of each house, and then they own the panels, but they sell the power back at a rate that would be comparable to what the people would have been paying to the public utility anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, a makeshift homeowners association essentially takes ownership of the panels, and then the community can add to it as they see fit. So it's a way to kind of break down some of these financial barriers and have the developer do the right thing at the same time.
Cool, very interesting. Let me turn to the IFTF staff that are on the call. Do you want to dive in and ask questions?
So I'll throw out a question. This is Chris Hartenberg. This is actually for Allison. Allison, your most recent New York Times column talked about Kaiser Permanente and their sort of redesign of healthcare. And I'm wondering if you could speak, or you and the other guests might speak a little bit about designing suburbs to encourage sort of healthier lifestyles.
Sure, absolutely. The Kaiser Permanente effort is quite interesting, and I'll just touch on it quite briefly here, but it has to do with the hospital's sort of commitment and investment in sustainable retrofit and new builds for their hospital facilities is one part, and they found that they actually have saved significant money in large part because they're so huge that they can approach, say, a carpet manufacturer or a materials manufacturer and say, we need a non-toxic version of this, you pay for the R&D, we'll buy so much of it that it'll be worth your while. And so they've been able to do this with a variety of manufacturers. I suggested in that article that there's no reason why a major home builder couldn't use the same sort of leveraging power to work with material suppliers, but I've seen precious little of that happen anywhere. But if you think of, say, a developer who's building 50,000 homes, swapped out, vinyl siding for a less toxic alternative, then you're beginning to see sort of real change in sustainable building. I think the sort of most obvious and easiest way to improve the health of communities is to make walkable ones. I've written quite a lot about my own neighborhood, which is actually in San Francisco, but feels quite suburban. Within 5 minutes walk from my house, I have public library, market, bar station, 4 restaurants, free school, free playgrounds, and a sort of nature preserve. And how can we sort of, I sort of see this as a model. I can get on BART and get downtown in 10 minutes from here, yet I'm here and I feel very much like I'm in Mayberry RFD. Now, this seems like a perfect example for me for future suburban development of why can't you, it feels totally suburban where I'm living, yet I live in San Francisco and sort of one of the largest cities in the country. So there are so many ways to adopt seemingly urban aspects of a city into future suburban development that, in my experience, most developers have been very resistant to, even as much as building a cafe within walking distance of housing, which there's sort of no argument for that, I think. Another thing, and then I'll let someone else do, and Eric, you touched on this a bit, but not only do developers just want to keep on spitting out those single-family homes and walk away, it's not in their economic interest to build varied housing types, so they're only building those single families. It's not incentivized enough for them to build any kind of diversity of housing, whether it's multifamily or apartment housing or townhomes or whatever else. It just doesn't make their economic formula work. So I think
I'd like to jump in on that, though.
Go ahead, June.
Through our book and the kinds of responses we've been getting to it, there's a great deal of interest from the large home builders and Builder Magazine, interviewing my co-author and other things, that they're recognizing that they're going to have to change their builder model and come up with new products. So they're starting to invest more in their kind of in-town divisions that do multi-unit housing product. And they're really very attuned to the changes in demographics as Americans are aging, and the expectation that a far fewer percentage of American households will be family households with children going into the future, and recognizing that we sort of overbuilt that one housing
type.
And so I expect there to be some pretty big shifts in the big home builders. They're probably going to, hedge their bets. But I think that there's going to be a lot more willingness to engage in mixed-use development. What's more complicated for them is they're going to need to partner with developers who have expertise in other building types. And that's just more complicated and also more expensive.
Yeah. One thing I'm running into a lot.
Potentially more profitable if they do it right.
If I can jump in for 1 second. One thing I run into a lot is that there's this preconception about the marketplace, and it may in fact be very true, that if you have a house that has a few too many oddities, it simply won't resell well. So if it's built just a little different, if it's got too few baths for the number of bedrooms, and that's a dramatic example, right? But if it's a little off, it's just not going to sell, and there won't be enough buyers for it. And I think that freezes everybody, and everybody's really worried about flipping houses and reselling more than they are about staying and actually making the houses and the neighborhood theirs and appropriating the land, the streets, and the way we're talking. I think part of this is actually a frame of mind about what a house is and that it's an investment and not a dwelling for your lives and your family.
Absolutely. And I spent about a year when I was working with IDEO interviewing both master plan community builders, developers, and also residents and potential residents. And the resale thing was such a completely dominating thread in everyone's conversation that you're exactly right. I can't buy this, even if it's perfect for me, because it's not going to sell for this reason. It needs to have this many bedrooms. Not at all based on what that person's actual needs are, but what their perceived future profit was down the road. And also, the American dream is all about the single-family home. It's not about an apartment. It's not about a condo.
Yep.
And that's a really rough one to crack. And I don't see I do agree that some builders are starting to recognize the importance of switching to this different type, but what I personally have not seen yet is a recognition that they better be building some pretty amazing multifamily housing to begin to convince people that it's okay to have a single-family home alternative.
I think one of the things that's going to crack this nut is not advertising or promotion or some new way of looking at housing, but actually sort of poverty or financial crisis. And I'm drawn here to the first chapter of Doug Rushkoff's book, Life Incorporated, where he says he grew up in Long Island in a relative lower middle class neighborhood where every weekend one of the parents in the cul-de-sac would bring out, would fire up the barbecue, and then everybody would bring out their chicken and their hot dogs and the kids would play. And it was a block party every weekend. And then his dad got a promotion and they moved, I think, up to Westchester. And all of a sudden, every house had a white picket fence and every house had its own barbecue, and the block party died.
Yep.
The block party just went away. Bye-bye. No more block party. So, and then it's a matter of inviting people, and whom do you and don't you invite, and it's, you know, reciprocity, and a whole series of other things suddenly show up that you didn't even realize were going to be there when you're busy having the block party on the only barbecue at the playground.
Right.
One thing that's interesting about that being in the New York area is that Long Island in particular is experiencing a crisis of housing. There's nowhere else to build, or it's perceived that the island is full. And there's a number of initiatives to really look at the existing downtowns on Long Island, of which there are over 150 that have languished for decades and are basically big, you know, commuter parking lots, large parts of them. And there's a lot of capacity there to address the needs of younger people and older people on Long Island who are leaving because there's no place for them to live there. And that's a huge economic drain, a brain drain, a future, sort of looking at a depopulated future for Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually a design competition coming up to look at how those existing downtowns on Long Island might be repurposed along these same themes.
Let me go back to Cassie, Jamet, David, Jason.
Hi.
Go ahead, David. Well, I just had a question about the relationship between, this is Jason from IFTF, between suburbs and declining cities. So tomorrow morning I get on a plane to fly home to Detroit, specifically suburban Detroit. And obviously a lot, I mean, Detroit is almost kind of the exemplification around the world of a declining city right now. But not a lot of attention is being given to the suburbs. I read my hometown newspaper and see that a lot of the same problems are happening there. But so much of the energy is concentrated in the urban areas. And of course, Michigan is a state with overall declining revenue. So it's everyone trying to get at the same, you know, the same share of a decreasing pot. So I guess I'm wondering, have you seen any interesting stories or relationships between declining suburbs and declining cities, any ways that they can begin to cooperate, collaborate, to regrow together?
Anybody?
It's an important nut to crack. And Allison, did you want to say?
Yeah, Bueller?
I haven't.
There certainly are movements afoot in some of the other Midwestern cities where the inner suburbs are forming coalitions, an example like the Kansas City First Suburbs Coalition, and meeting together the elected leaders and planning officials in those adjacent suburbs and trying to address the issues of, you know, residents aging in place and how can they adapt their houses to make them more visitable and accessible, or replacing the boilers, or doing, you know, small interventions, small investments to improve their communities, and sharing ideas about those things.
You're not talking. Bye.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, especially with the Detroit region, is that the suburbs and the cities were so economically linked. You know, it was really the embodiment of the American ideal that you'd work for one of the big three automakers, and then you'd live in Bloomfield Hills or something like that. With the death of Detroit, it goes to follow that the suburbs would kind of soon follow. And you almost can't solve the problem with one without addressing the problems of the other.
You know, didn't at some point that deal, that bargain, or that unspoken relationship start to shift where the cities and the suburbs began to compete for tax base and began to compete over transit and who paid for what, and they became in many places sort of enemies rather than sort of symbiotes?
Yeah, somewhere in the early 90s we had this phenomenon. It was a very American phenomenon called edge cities. And the idea was that people got tired of
taking into the city. So industry and companies and corporations started locating their center of business in rather larger suburbs. So what you had instead of the typical model of people living in the burbs and commuting into the city, they'd commute from suburb to suburb, and one suburb would become built up and attract other industry. And, you know, outside of Philadelphia, there's a kind of model edge city called King of Prussia, which I think hosts the biggest mall on the East Coast, unfortunately. And you know, it's kind of the prototypical edge city that nobody went to Philadelphia anymore. They kind of sidestepped it entirely to go over to another burb. And suddenly the idea of where you live became unimportant, and then the push for cheap fuel throughout the 80s and 90s kind of furthered that idea that, oh, I'll just drive more and it won't be a big deal.
To swing back to the infrastructure question, one of the other prototypical edge cities is Tyson's Corner outside Washington, D.C., and right now there's a huge effort, you know, part of a long planning process to bring the Metrorail through Tyson's Corner and out to Dulles Airport, and they're going to thread four stations through the conglomeration, the unplanned conglomeration of Tyson's Corner at you know, great additional expense rather than skirting and having the Metrorail go along the highway. And we'll have to stay tuned to see how that changes the area around Tyson's Corner. The expectation is that a lot more people will be living there. At the moment, there's maybe 17,000 people who live there, and, you know, I don't know how many, a couple hundred thousand who work there. So the jobs-housing imbalance is quite severe. So can expect to see that change, but not it's not going to be a turnaround on a dime. It's going to take quite a while for that to happen.
And that particular stretch of metro has been under planning for 15 years. So I will smile when it's actually installed, however it works out.
Well, eat your proverbial hat.
Well, I don't know that I'm going to go that far because I will have waited 20 years, so I think the hat will be moldy by then. David, Jemme, Kathy, any other questions?
Yeah, this is David from IFTF. I grew up in the suburbs in Mountain View and Los Altos, and California. And, you know, my memory of the suburbs as a teenager is just that they were horrible. And, you know, I'd love to hear more from the people on the line here about how to make suburbs a good experience for teens. I mean, I remember at nights in high school, our friends just kind of sitting around. Everyone had a car who I was friends with, and we just kind of would drive around, and there was just kind of nothing to do. We would invent different things, like cubing. We would buy big blocks of ice and slide down the hills at Stanford Golf Course, or sort of perennially search for a frat party at Stanford that we could crash. You know, we would also go hoteling. We would get dressed up in suits and try to crash weddings at the old Ricky's Hyatt on El Camino, just for in search of anything fun to do at night. You know, I think that teenagers are the people that really suffer the most in the suburbs in terms of lacking for anything, much of anything to do, even when you do get the car. You know, there's just nothing there. I remember meeting kids who grew up in San Francisco or in Berkeley, and they just had so much more interesting times in their sort of late teens and the end of high school. You know, was this just sort of my own dysfunctional experience, or was it good for me that there was nothing fun to do at night, or is that really a problem with suburbs that can be addressed?
This does explain a lot of your character, David. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jerry.
I grew up on the other end of the Bay. I grew up in Marin County, and I'd say probably a lot of adolescents spent their time doing the same activities that you did. I mean, I think teenagers are forever bored. So I think I don't know what the ideal place is for them. I think that they're more bored the more rural things get. I had a great experience growing up in the suburbs, but I will say that once we were sort of old enough, all we did was go to San Francisco.
Yeah.
But certainly I think the way, and again, Marin is not the classic suburb for many of the reasons I described. I think that the way that most communities and subdivisions are designed now, absolutely, there's certainly nothing for teenagers to do. It's hard enough for small kids to do anything. my in-laws live in Orange County, and it takes about 20 minutes to drive to the nearest parking lot. The nearest playground from where they are. And it just sort of baffles my mind that they couldn't even design the thing around the playground. So I think the question of all age groups become a huge one, and I think the most interesting issue is if we can just not focus specifically on teenagers here, but multi-generational developments in general. I think that the way that most suburbs are designed currently, it is for sort of a young family. And then what happens is the kids grow up and you've got just a bunch of adults in a community that was designed for small kids, instead of creating something where you could have senior housing, apartment housing, young families. And then I think that sort of naturally leads to more diverse experiences and opportunities and retail and whatever mm-hmm. else to serve that sort of multi-dimensional community. So that seems the best way to address it.
I think folks in the public health sector who are really tapping into these connections and the need to address the high cost of the sort of middle class lifestyle in the United States, the sedentary, car dependent lifestyle, and not only from the food perspective, but also from the physical design perspective. And there's research being done to document the public health dangers, basically, of living in one of the most, the more recently built suburbs. And I agree that it's unconscionable for children not to be able to walk to a playground or walk to school. And then there's a fear side of that. And one of the things that's more interesting right. that's happening now are what do they call them? The walking school buses?
Yes,
where kids get together with a parent and all kind of walk in a group to school because people are driving their kids to a school that's only, a few blocks away. So
right.
So those kinds of lifestyle changes and addressing some of the perceptions as well as the physical design barriers. But one could argue about the teenagers that's part of what's fueled the urban renaissance, the back to the city movement that we've had in recent decades, are all these disaffected teens from the 70s, 80s, and 90s who leave the suburbs and don't have any intention of going back when they start raising their own families, which, again, is something that those home builders are going to have to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. There's another piece of this. I'm going to bring in a really remote angle, but I think it's actually a big angle in this country, which is we invented adolescence here. It used to be that pretty young kids started doing stuff. They started getting to work, and at 12, 14, 16, by 16, they were effectively fully employed. Then we built the public education system, and we invented this notion of adolescence, and now we expect kids to be in school and really not work until they're 18. Then we want them to go for 4 years to college, probably not really knowing what they're going to be, and then they should look around and think about getting a job. And they're 22 years old, typically, by this age. And that's 10 years after kids used to be actually getting busy. So when kids are cruising the neighborhood and doing, scooping the loop, which is one term that I've heard, used a bunch of times, it's partly because we've invented this period where they aren't expected to do a thing.
Right.
And they have no serious engagement to the community. They have no serious task to go do. It's not like they're going to go do a barn raising for one of the neighbors. Nobody has organized that. So I think that this is actually sort of deeper and more pervasive than just how we've built cities. It's also about our expectations about childhood and labor and schools and all that stuff mixed in.
Do you guys remember in the 60s and early 70s when developers would want to build a community, the local township or suburb would force them to build an elementary school? And you have a lot of examples throughout the country of these kind of older suburbs, and you can tell they're older by the mature trees and by the size of the side yards. And they were kind of built around a central plan of an elementary school and playground in the center and then a community around it. And somewhere along the way, it happened, I think, in the 80s, communities became scared of developers. And the kind of tables turned. And suddenly, developers were calling all the shots and dictating all the terms because each community was so desperate to get developers in. And now, nowadays, the developer approaches a community and says, we want to build this, and you're going to give us this, this, and this, and if you don't, we'll just screw you. We'll go somewhere else. And that's kind of the problem. What we really need are these communities
kind of join up with their surrounding adjacent communities and almost, in a way, almost unionize and say, no, Mr. Developer, if you're going to come here, you're going to build clean, healthy, sustainable, community-driven parcels, and you're going to like it. Otherwise, we're collectively not going to let you build. And it almost takes that kind of unionization of local governments to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that suggests that the community members are going to be in agreement, because that's another, and Eric and I have been talking about holding some workshops on this subject in the city about how to sort of collectively organize people in a way that doesn't just result, like every community meeting I ever go to, is everyone standing up with their own agenda, like, I don't want that here because I won't be able to park in front of the library for story time, and I won't be, like, everyone has their quite individualistic need that they have to speak to, despite their seeming concern for the larger community, which is also, I think, a relatively recent development, partly aided and abetted by homeless mm-hmm. associations, which is a whole other, you know, ball of wax to throw into this conversation.
And also zoning, which is another big ball of wax.
Right.
I want to throw in some very strange things.
Hey,
Karpinski, and I live in Santa Rosa. And I think this actually was the place where the first mall was created. And it's gone through some changes lately, but it's still there, Cottingtown Mall. And I, when you were talking about playgrounds, I was thinking the first playground in the country that was public playground was, I think, in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. Anyway, I live in a mobile home park, Sequoia Gardens, a very nice mobile home park, but the mobile home park owner is trying to convert it to condominiums and sell us each our 752 square feet of land for $100,000. We don't like that idea, but and I'm on the homeowners board of directors as of a couple of weeks ago, but it's a different experience, and I wonder if you think of this mobile home park as a sort of micro suburb, and I'll stop there.
Well, I could maybe respond to the question of affordability, and I don't know, you know, this particular project where you're located, but certainly as transit comes in and in some suburbs and the understanding of the value around that's associated with walkable suburbanism, there's going to be a real price premium associated with that, and there's a risk that existing affordable housing in the form of garden apartment complexes or mobile home parks might be threatened. And so that's going to require some discussion and perhaps some protections or negotiations to make sure that that these locations that are transit adjacent remain open to
affordable.
All. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that conversation needs to start now, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And trust, I think, can help out there.
Exactly. Other questions from people on the call? Please jump in. Identify yourself first, please.
So this is Kathy Vian from the Institute, and I'm just wondering, the conversation has been largely focused on U.S. suburbs. I'm just wondering if any of you have any experience at all with suburban thinking outside the U.S. and what's going on in, you know, countries as sort of diverse as China and then some of the Latin American countries, even in Europe, what's happening in the world of suburbs.
I can speak about that a little bit. This is June. First of all, I grew up in a number of different suburbs, and two of them were overseas. So when I was a child, I lived in Saudi Arabia in an Aramco compound that was designed to be a walled microcosm of American 1960s suburbia with the little houses and literally crabgrass, because that's the only thing that would grow in the desert. And then later,
do what you're doing.
and later I lived in a suburb outside London in my early adolescence, and I'll have to say that there was a huge shift when I moved to the United States at age 14. In London, because of transit, buses and trains, I had great mobility, even though I was in a suburb. Mm-hmm. And in outside Boston, I lived in a suburb that was equally distant from the center of the city, but I was marooned. and couldn't get around. So that was a huge letdown, personally. but one of the things that's interesting is to look at how other countries around the world are adopting the U.S. development model in various mm-hmm. ways. And from the building of large enclosed shopping malls, you know, the bigger the better in China, although that's not necessarily working out so well. They're having the same problems in tenanting those enormous shopping centers as some of the more recent efforts here in the United States, like Xanadu in New Jersey, which may never open. And then you've got examples like in India, where the same company, I can't remember the name right now, that built the nano car, the tiny portable car, is getting into the subdivision business, and they're they started construction on a prototype suburb that's targeted towards the same folks who can afford the nano car. So it's like a starter suburb that's about 30 miles north of Mumbai. And they're calling it a green suburb. And green, they mean it in the most literal sense, that there is open space, that there's yards. So it's actually this, you know, much lower density development pattern where you've got room to park your nano mm-hmm. and a bit of green outside of the city. So we're going to see, I think, the proliferation of the patterns that have been so dominant here in the past 30, 40 years being reproduced around the world, adopted. The units in the development in India are much, 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 much smaller than you would find here.
Yes. And yet I think there's some places where those developments are being intercepted, and people are beginning to understand that something different has to happen, that we can't just – I think what you just described, June, is happening – is happening all over the place, but there are many cases now where people are deciding that that model simply won't last. Allison, are you going to jump in?
Oh, just the idea of smaller spaces and also multifamily housing. I mean, unfortunately and not surprisingly, the American export is, you know, bring the American dream to these other places, where I think of certainly countries in Europe and most parts of Asia are just have no expectation of the space that Americans do, and also of the number of cars that Americans do. And so that's affected development in a positive direction away from American ones. But yes, as we continue to export, there's an actual replica of Orange County in China called Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
That has all the same houses and whatever else. And it's just kind of horrifying to watch. Like, don't pick that up, you know.
Oh, I hadn't heard of that one.
Of course, yeah, it's just Orange County, China. It's awful.
Nobody else makes the interest on your mortgage tax a tax advantage.
That's
one of the reasons.
Yep.
One of the reasons why the American dream is to own your own house, because that's your major cash reserve for the rest of your life.
Yeah. So
and we've been subsidizing that
more,
model, since the 1930s. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's true in Germany or in Bolivia or in China.
Yep. In fact, I know for a fact a friend of mine in Argentina, they had to pay cash for their house. They don't do home loans there. So it's just a whole different sort of cultural approach to it.
But these things change. In Germany, you used to have to drop money into what was called the Bausparkasse, basically a savings bank. And there were no mortgages in Germany 30 years ago, 4 years ago. Today, mortgages, everywhere you look, it's completely turned to the U.S. model. And I think that, you know, I'd love to see a survey of tax laws worldwide to see how the mortgage interest deduction actually fits worldwide and whether it's changing over time. That would be a fascinating thing to see.
Agreed.
Hi.
Go back to go ahead.
I was wondering if I could jump in here. This is Ellen Dunham Jones. I'm June's co-author and have been really enjoying the conversation. But, you know, on the topic of banking and mortgages, what's particularly interesting right now is that with the new, all of the new kind of mortgage reform that's going on, there's very little talk that I know of to actually try to change anything to do with residential in a significant way. But in commercial, it is quite interesting. There's a proposal out now to that is not being driven by design, but is being driven totally as a kind of banking solution to getting the toxic assets off of the banks, to potentially turn a lot of the commercial underperforming properties, as those start crashing even further than they are now, turning them into parks and things. And it's beginning to it's getting a lot more play than sort of when this idea first emerged. It's actually starting to get more serious. So I think there's I find myself actually quite optimistic that we are on the cusp of some pretty major changes in how we build suburbia. You hit it with the rising transportation costs, changing demographics. I don't think we're going to continue to really see the American dream play out in quite the same with the same vigor in as we come out of this recession.
Mm-hmm. From your lips to God's ears, right?
Who knows?
let me go back through our – go ahead.
I was just going to follow up with the idea that Ellen introduced. I think, you know, this connects back to the comments that Allison made earlier about finding ways to re-green and maybe make more productive landscapes in suburbia for growing food and other things. That this idea that the banking industry is interested and is recognizing that there's a surplus of commercially zoned land across the United States, and thinking that by reducing that supply, it can better sort of accommodate the fortunes of the remaining land is huge. So just mm-hmm. want to emphasize that.
So we're getting toward the end of our call, and I wanted to go back to our guests, Eric, June, and Allison, and ask them to, if you could pick one thing that either, you can go positive or negative here, either something that makes you really optimistic, something you've mentioned on the call or something you haven't mentioned, a case study, a place, a movement that makes you really optimistic that this is going to happen, or if you could name what you think the principal obstacle or obstacles are to this ever actually happening in a meaningful way. So something really positive or something really negative under the theme. Eric?
Well, I think my answer is going to be a little bit of both. With this economic downturn, I've seen a surge of interest among, quote-unquote, traditional developers suddenly interested in exploring new models and new ways of building. You know, they're seeing this downturn as almost a mandate that they need to change their ways. And times are good. They think that they're great at their jobs, and there's no reason to question it. But when times are bad, they start questioning things that they normally overlooked. So that's both giving me hope and making me realize that the major roadblock is how developers build, finance, and approach all of these different communities. I was just in Phoenix for Green Build last month, and the head of Green Building there said, you know, we've got 50,000 vacant homes in Phoenix. So the idea of building new green models just seems almost preposterous. Because what are you going to do with this existing infrastructure of new houses that's sitting empty? So what we need is really a strategy to take this existing, the existing suburbs and transform them.
And retrofit. Thank you. June?
Well, I want to be optimistic and say that our research unearthed all of these retrofits across the country that were already built. And I just imagine... I'm excited in imagining what the second and third generation of retrofits are going to be like moving forward, and all of the different ideas as the creative energy of younger folks, of designers, sort of shifts focus to the inner suburbs in particular and other areas of opportunity. And I also think that having a number of examples out there visualized that policymakers and politicians and folks in with access to financing can visit and see is a really promising set of circumstances looking to the future, to counterbalance too some of the really dispiriting images of kind of the old formulas that are failing.
Thanks so much, June. Allison?
I'll choose the positive end too, and maybe focus on the why not? You know, it's a new year coming. I think the health and wellness angle is a really interesting one now that I hope continues to sort of be as impactful as it's starting to be. I think WalkScore is really, so far, helping to revolutionize the way a lot of people are thinking about real estate and resale value. And there's a lot of great stats now on, you know, your walk score, the number of points in your walk score correlates to the increase in home value. It's like, you know, a point per $3,000 of home value or something like that. My neighborhood, for instance, has a 92 on walk score, so, you know, I can't remember what sort of the average is. And then also stats on, you know, how the average suburbanite is 10 pounds heavier and whatever else. And there's just, like, a lot of really good studies coming out about health as it relates to livability, and also some programs that were mentioned here, like the Walking School Bus and also the Fryker organization that's getting kids to bike to school and incentivizes them for doing so. And
what's
kind
it called?
Of change people. Fryker, F-R-E-I-K-E-R. It's part of the – it was started in Boulder by two dads who were tired of their kids getting driven, you know, half a mile to school. And now I think it's rolling out in at least 14 different locations across the country. It's part of the Safer Streets program.
Thank you.
I think people can relate to a lot of the issues we're talking about when you bring it back to their family and kind of their family health. This is certainly local sustainability too. So I think – talking about these things in a way that speaks to those sort of emotional triggers, I think, has been really helpful.
Awesome. Thank you. Kathy, any closing thoughts or Jamie?
One thing that I think needs to be recognized as we move ahead on this is that, this is Jamie Cascio from IFTF, is that whatever we do going forward, if we don't understand why in America in particular, people continue to move into suburbs, and you do have a lot of people who claim to like suburbs. We don't understand why there's that pattern. Any attempt to retrofit, to remake, to reimagine the suburbs is likely to fail simply because you're not actually answering the demands, answering the needs of the people who are living there. Now, that doesn't mean that these are bad ideas. What it means is that there needs to be, I think, some real complexity of consideration as to why we have the patterns that we have today. And it's not just because we have developers and evil developers, and it's not just because of, you know, tax breaks. I mean, there are certain kinds of issues around independence, around mobility. I mean, bear in mind that Americans move on average every 5 years. I mean, the notion that people want to resell the house simply because they want to flip is mistaken. It's actually because they recognize that most people don't stay in a house for 20 years, you know, for a generation or more.
But I think that's changed dramatically. I think that pattern of mobility is not going to be like that for a long, long time with the job market how it is now. So.
I think you're mistaken. I honestly think you're mistaken. I think that this kind of mobility is likely to remain the pattern for quite a while.
Interesting. Well, let me go back over the call and recap what we covered. And
wait.
Calls. Oh, please.
One more thing.
Go ahead.
And that is that if you want to know about this stuff, you should read The Death and Life of Great American Cities.
Right. James, good.
Yeah, I think we've all got that on our shelf.
Thanks, Dick. Thanks for putting that in. I developed a whole bunch of resources around this topic, and they're all in my brain. So I posted to Twitter a link into my brain on the topic Reburbia, and there's that book and a whole bunch of others are around it. So if you want to go noodle around through these topics, and after this call, I will go add some more things and republish my brain online. So there'll be more resources there as well. So let me recap what we covered as quickly as I can. We started out with Eric talking about the Reburbia contest that was started by Inhabitat and Dwell magazines, where he was a judge, and how his expectations, he was sort of delighted and disappointed because the ideas were way beyond what he had, what his preconceptions may have been. He thinks that there's this unanimous, or at least in that contest, he noticed that there was this unanimity of suburbs stink. No project said we're going to be more suburban living is great. That was really interesting. Then there's this dilemma that in many ways this transcends sustainability and livability and construction. The problems are really large here. And that this American myth that you're supposed to live in Quail Run, where the quail are actually decimated by planting the housing tract, turns into houses that are all the same, with all of them meeting minimum standards of local code so that they blow down in hurricanes, and so they don't do a lot that's really beyond what has to be done. He called this a falsified dream, and developers are busy building places with zero lot lines and 5 feet between lots, and nobody uses their front yards, and the backyard is fenced, and that's pretty, it's very difficult to do. June talked about her book, in which they've described a retrofitting that's already been going on for 10 to 15 years of suburban forms, many of which are single-use, car-dependent, low-density things like big-box stores. But there are also some larger lot parcels, and this is happening a lot in older failed suburbs. So we're taking shopping centers, malls, and garden apartment complexes and changing them around. And this is a combination of wholesale redevelopment, of re-inhabiting old places and just adaptive reuse, and also re-greening, taking, for example, the roofs of big box stores and putting solar panels on them, let's say, or gardens. Allison talked about how, wait a minute, lots of people actually love suburbia, so they don't see these problems. And when she wrote a recent Times column, she got 500 comments, many of which were, hey, back off. Why do city people want to tell suburb people what to do? She grew up in Marin and walked to school and considered that a pretty nice place, but maybe the suburban people aren't actually missing these things. And then she's wondering about retrofit, sort of how does this work? How do you go beyond the restructuring of a single building to actually the public transportation, the streetscape, and street infrastructure, and how does that all work? June talked about how, yes, often sort of there's a few developments that are actually working on streets, like in Arlington, Virginia, and there's a cathedral corridor as well. I mentioned the 798 Art Zone in Beijing, where there's an entire military base that was decommissioned and is now a really interesting art and restaurant scene. Eric talked about people in the burbs love the burbs like they love their political party. They see it as the only one of two alternatives, where they see the city as full of crime and filth. So this contrast drives them to the burbs, and he's looking for a third alternative. He's looking for a place that actually gets rid of the fiefdoms, that these preposterous fiefdoms of neighboring villages that have redundant police, city, and trash departments, and won't talk to each other. That's probably the worst part of the whole thing. Allison talked about, I asked about what happens when suburbs break, and Allison said, well, remember, suburbs are diverse. They're diverse by region, they're diverse by when they were built, they're diverse by the socioeconomic makeup. There's more poverty in suburbs than there is in urban regions. So why don't we get more regional conversations going? A lot of these commercial strips have been decimated, but there's still a resistance to retrofit them out of fear of what might come in instead of them. So there's some big obstacles here. You know, how do you, the money to tear down these things, but the rebuild may not be as dramatic as what happened before to actually build these places. But still, there's I think everybody's wondering, where's the money going to come from to dig up these properties and change them into something more viable? So we talked a bit about sky vegetables, to retrofit big boxes, to put agriculture on top of them, also the notion of solar power on top of them, and the benefits to communities if their food and their jobs become local. There's incredible acreage available. There's 1.1 million acres in shopping centers in the U.S. That's 5.6 times the area of New York City that has been paved into these shopping malls and centers, says June. So yet the suburbs are managed as home rule municipalities. They compete for taxes. They have their own law. A whole variety of strange things go on in these suburban malls. Chris piped in from ISTF, and he said, what about healthier suburbs? What's happening there? Pointing out some of Allison's writing about the Kaiser Permanente's initiatives. And he talked about how Kaiser is big enough that it has buying power and can actually go co-develop a new toxic-free carpet that then they buy enough of that it creates a market, and now that carpet is actually a popular carpet. Also, this notion of making walkable communities. Within 5 minutes of her place in San Francisco, she has a library, BART, 4 restaurants, lots of nature, markets, and schools. You know, the walkability quotient, and there's actually a website she mentioned at the very end called WalkScore, where you can type in your zip code and see what your walk score is. Her walkability quotient is really high, and yet that correlates directly with home prices. And I think that we have this 800-pound gorilla in the room of our attitude toward housing and this shadow of home prices, that if you have a nice neighborhood and it's walkable, then suddenly it'll get priced up. The variety, the diversity of the community will get priced out. This is a very typical common pattern in U.S. cities, and I think it's actually a long-term, a very damaging pattern for us. June talked about how home builders are really, really interested. They think they need new products for this new market. So they're attuned to demographic changes. They know they've overbuilt that one housing type. They need to figure out how to do this mixed-use thing, though, and they're not very good at it necessarily. So that's where I pointed out that this perspective really matters, that we're seeing houses as investments and not as dwellings all too often. Allison talked about how in her 1 year working with IDEO on a project, that resale was the dominant worry of people who were participating in the studies, that they would be saying, yeah, great idea, but, you know, I won't be able to resell that. My property value will go down. So this notion is dominant in the conversation. And I actually think that poverty is a driver here, that poorer people are forced to live in circumstances that we consider beneath us that are actually better for community, where they have to share resources, where they don't have as many boundaries, where they live closer together. And it's maybe this is a dark way of looking at it, but I think that prosperity breeds this cocooning, and I don't know of enough prosperous countries where this has been built properly. And maybe Northern European cities with walking zones and sort of mixed housing are a good example here. Allison talked about Long Island having a real, I even pronounced it like Long Island, having a crisis of housing where they see the island as being full. And there's 150 downtowns, though, that have languished, and there's a competition going on right now on how to redesign those. Jason from IFTF talked about, you know, what about declining suburbs versus cities? How does that play out? And he's about to, you know, fly home to suburban Detroit, where Detroit downtown is the poster child of redevelopment and what's happening and what needs to happen, but the suburbs are being ignored. Is there cooperation? June pointed out the Kansas City First Suburbs Coalition, where they're doing a variety of things about accessibility and residents aging in place and a series of small interventions, but the suburbs are coming together to work together. Eric talked about how cities and suburbs are economically linked, and it used to be you'd live in the burbs and commute into town, but then when downtown Detroit died, then the suburbs sort of would seem to follow. And in many cases, cities and suburbs have become enemies, not symbiotes anymore. And there's this notion of edge cities where why go into the city anymore if you can go to King of Prussia or Tyson's Corner? And we got a nice description of some of the ways that those edge cities have become major metropolitan centers of their own. The metro in D.C. is going to thread 4 stations through Tyson's Corner rather than go by where the freeway is and let people walk into the center. David Evan Harris talked about grew up in Mountain View, and he talked. His memory of it is terrible. That the teens just didn't know what to do in the evening, and they would do all sorts of things: crash weddings, crash parties, find frat parties, do whatever they could. And when he compared notes with teens who had grown up in San Francisco or in Berkeley, they seemed to have many more interesting things to do. Allison talked about her growing up in Marin and saying, you know, maybe teenagers are just forever bored, and when they get old enough, they just went into San Francisco to do stuff. In Orange, she has relatives who live in Orange County, and it takes them 20 minutes to drive to the nearest playground. Why, how did we build cities like that? And how are we avoiding this notion of multi-age, diverse communities? We have whole neighborhoods that are built for young families, and when they grow up, all of a sudden everybody leaves. Relatives of mine live in a neighborhood which 6 years ago had the most amazing Halloween you could imagine, with many of the houses lit up, and you go now, and basically it's dark. There are very few families that are doing anything. It's sort of like that. June talked about that, the health sector tracking this and this notion of walking school buses, where parents are actually chaining together, not literally chaining together, but sort of escorting kids to school instead of taking buses. There's another movement called Fricker, F-R-I-K-E-R, about bicycling to school. So there's lots of different ways of trying to do that. So how will we – Allison's interested in how people will organize to do these things when homeowners seem to have their own agenda and their own rights, and they're worried about, well, I won't be able to – see the you know, I won't be able to see my view if somebody plants something there. I won't be able to get to the trash or whatever it is. Dick Karpinski lives in Santa Rosa, which had the first mall possibly, and he talks about the first public park maybe being Golden Gate Park way back when, and talking about his mobile home park being converted to condos possibly and how they're trying to fight that. Allison brought up affordability and said, look, as transit comes in and the value of walking goes in, it's a dollar premium on homes. And later on she talked about how 1 point in this walkability score can be $3,000 in property value. It's quite amazing. And it's really threatening existing housing. Kathy said, well, this seems like a very U.S.-focused conversation. How about outside? What's happening in other places? June grew up in 2 overseas sites. One was a Saudi Arabian Aramco compound that was made to look very American, except the normal grasses wouldn't grow, so it was crabgrass. And then also she lived outside London, where she had a lot of mobility. I experienced this also. I lived for a year in Berlin, where I was old enough that I could just get around. And then at 14, she moved to the U.S., about the same for me, into Boston. And she was in the Boston burbs and was suddenly marooned. So other countries in the world seem to be adopting the U.S. model. There's actually an Orange County in China. That is an attempt to emulate Orange County here. But they're having trouble. So some of these malls are having trouble tenanting the malls, but they're also building gated communities and a variety of other things. In India, Tata, the company that built the Nano, apparently is also building some subdivisions 30 miles north of Mumbai, and it's greening them. And by what it means by green is yards. You'll have some space, which is what you don't have if you live downtown in Mumbai. So we need to wonder whether these trends are actually happening. It'd be interesting to see some studies about that. Allison talked about this idea of smaller spaces and multifamily housing, and the rest of the world has very different expectations about space. We brought up the mortgage interest tax break, and we'd love to know from anybody if this is true in many countries and if it's changing over time, if other countries actually give people a tax break for their mortgage interest. Ellen, the co-author of the book that June wrote as well, talked about how this really, there's new mortgage reform in the books because of all the financial crisis, but really little change on the residential level. But at the commercial level, there are some solutions that are coming up to help convert underperforming properties into parks and things like that. So there might be some really interesting things there. She believes we're on the cusp of really major changes, that the demographic pressures and other pressures are going to drive big change. June sees ways of regreening landscapes and says there's a surplus of commercially zoned land in the U.S., and maybe changes there would help. In summary, Eric talked about both positive and negative. The positive that there's a surge of interest. The developers are really exploring how to do this, and there's a real, they see this as a real mandate for change. And yet there's roadblocks. You know, how developers work, it's the roadblock. And he went to Phoenix to a conference called Green Build, where one of the people there said, look, we have 50,000 vacant homes in Phoenix. What do we mean we're going to build new green homes? That's, you know, we need to actually retrofit or reoccupy these 50,000 vacant homes. June talked about retrofits that are already happening everywhere, and she's looking forward to what the next and the next after generations of retrofits look like as new creative energy comes in. She thinks the examples are really good for everybody. Allison looked at health and wellness as a very interesting angle here, talked about ToxScore and FICR and the Safer Streets program. And then Jamais at the end of the call said, look, let's recognize if we don't understand why people keep going to suburbs, our attempts to reimagine these suburbs will fail because we're simply not going to be meeting demand. You know, people maybe are just becoming more mobile, and maybe they're not moving to flip their homes. Maybe they're moving because we're just a more mobile culture. Dick Karpinski at the very end said, look, make sure you read The Death and Life of Great American Cities by Jane Jacobs if you want some background to this, and there's a whole bunch of other resources in my brain online. So that brings us, we've been talking with Eric Corey-Fried, Allison Arieff, and June Williamson about Rethinking the Suburbs on this second FutureCast call held on December 17, 2009. Thank you very much for joining us. Please feel free to tell others about these calls and to tell us how to make them better. We are open for ideas. For Kathy Vian and IFTF, I'm Jerry Mikulski. We'll talk to you on the next call next month. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of FutureCast, IFTF's ongoing podcast series. We publish these shows under the Creative Commons Attribution License. You can learn more at our website at iftf.org.